Loeffler, who was appointed to her role earlier this year, are locked in runoff elections to be held on January 5th with the balance of the Senate in play. If both Republicans lose, Democrats will take over the chamber, potentially allowing Joe Biden to implement more of his agenda than he would under a divided government. John Ossoff, Purdue's Democratic challenger, has cast Purdue as a member of the Washington swamp who caters to the interests of corporate donors. Purdue was one of the 2017 tax bill's biggest boosters, publicly describing it as a windfall for average Americans. A single mom making $41,000 with a child is going to get 75% tax cut, he told a reporter when it passed. This is a great day for the middle class, he added. Before Perdue became a senator in 2015, he was a top executive for a string of companies, including Reebok, where in the early 2000s, the company inked major licensing deals with the NFL, the NBA, and the NHL. A review of his campaign contributions shows that Perdue has taken more than $425,000 from the owners of professional sports teams and their relatives. Some of the top donors include Divas Family, which owns the Orlando Magic, John Ingram, who owns the Nashville SC soccer team, Los Angeles Kings owner Philip Anschutz, and Cleveland Browns owner Jimmy Haslam. On the same day Perdue sent Mnuchin the letter, he received $3,000 in donations from three lobbyists at Georgia Link Public Affairs Group, a lobbying firm that was representing the Atlanta Braves. Because of the Braves' ownership structure, it's unlikely the team would have been affected by the regulation. But around that time, MLB was lobbying under rule, urging the Treasury to give its team owners the tax break. Perdue's campaign expenditures suggest he was in Atlanta that day, January 23, 2019. One of the lobbyists who contributed, John Tripp Martin, said he couldn't recall if the contribution was made at a fundraiser, but he said he did not discuss the tax exemption with Perdue. Another Perdue donor in the sports world is Loeffler. Before being picked by Georgia's governor to fill a vacant Senate seat in late 2019, Loeffler and her husband were prominent members of the business community and major donors to Republicans in the state and nationally. Loeffler was chief executive of Pact, a financial services company, and remains a co-owner of the Atlanta Dream. Her husband, Jeffrey Sprecher, is chief executive of Intercontinental Exchange, the parent company of New York Stock Exchange. Together, the couple has given about $70,000 in campaign contributions to Perdue. Mary Brock, who co-owns The Dream with Loeffler, has given Perdue more than $38,000. Loeffler did not respond to questions about whether she discussed the tax break regulation with Perdue. A spokeswoman for the team also declined to answer specific questions, saying in a statement that the Atlanta Dream is not a political entity and we are in the business of sports and entertainment. We are focused on building a successful team on the court and creating a top fan experience, he added. Like many WNBA teams, the Dream has not been profitable. Reversing the regulation would have certainly benefited Loeffler if the Dream became profitable, but tax experts ProPublica spoke to were split about whether a reversal could have cut her tax burden even if the team remained in the red. The landmark 2017 tax overhaul didn't just lower the headline tax rates for corporations such as Exxon or Facebook. It also included a more complicated but extremely valuable tax break for business known as pass-throughs. A pass-through is a corporate structure, anything from a solo graphic design operation to a large professional sports team that doesn't pay taxes itself. Instead, the income passes through to the owners, who then are on the hook for the taxes. The new tax law granted a 20% deduction to most, but not all, of these businesses. The hastily drafted bill left open to interpretation which sorts of businesses would be eligible to get this tax break. With tens of billions of dollars per year at stake, that ambiguity set off a flurry of lobbying as the Treasury Department set about writing regulations. A group of prominent tax academics who analyzed the bill warned that complex rules governing this new deduction will invite gaming opportunities because there is no particular logic as to who clearly fits into the preferred categories. As a result, taxpayers will be incentivized to engage in aggressive and socially costly tax gaming to fall within the haphazardly drawn lines. Purdue's January 2019 letter amounted to an effort to shift those lines to the benefit of sports team owners. He asked that Mnuchin allow owners of professional sports teams to claim a Section 199A deduction using the formal legal citation for tax break. It followed a similar push in October 2018 by MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred. In his letter to the Treasury, Manfred pleaded for the agency to let club owners take the tax break. Purdue also spoke on the phone to Mnuchin while the regulation was being hashed out in late November 2018, according to the Treasury Secretary's public calendar. The topic of the phone call is not specified.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is John. Welcome back to another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss what the normalizations of relations with Israel means for people and government of Bangladesh. And we shall also take a look at reactions of other nations across the subcontinent to the normalization deal with Israel.
The news of agreements on the normalization of relations between Israel and some Arab countries shocked the whole world. Apart from Pakistan and India, the largest and perhaps strongest subcontinental countries with higher stakes in the geopolitics of the region, there were reactions from other nations across the subcontinent. One of the ramifications of the US brokered deal is that countries feel pressed to calibrate their ties and priorities vis-a-vis Palestine and Israel.
With more than 150 million Muslims, Bangladesh is one of the most vocal countries about the Palestinian rights. Therefore, the news of the normalization deal with Israel was met with fury and fire.
People of Bangladesh, I think, most of the people, even 100% people support because of the Palestinian, because from the very, very tradition, historically, they support the cause of Bangladesh. And I didn't find any person against the Palestinians or supporting the Israel stand. And that's why I didn't find any difference of opinion on this issue, that the cause of the Palestinians should be properly upheld.
Despite the lack of direct hostilities, Israel and Bangladesh have no economic, defense or diplomatic ties. However, Bangladeshi-Palestinian solidarity goes well beyond history and politics. Father of the nation, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, was one of the supporters of independence for Palestine and even called it immoral to normalize relations with Israel without an independent Palestine. The world is divided in two, the exploiter and the exploited. We are in favor of the exploited. The people of Bangladesh are always beside the Palestinian people, Bangabandhu said.
People of Bangladesh didn't like this thing, that attempt, because the cause of the Palestinians is weakening because of that stand of some stand taken by the Arab countries to normalize the stand relation with Israel.
Back in 1972, Israel offered to recognize newly founded Bangladesh that was rejected without a second thought by Tajuddin Ahmed, the then premier of the country, which in 2021 will be 50 years old.
Despite a firm no to any overt or covert relation with Israeli regime, it is found in the recent years that Bangladeshi products are exported to the regime through the US or the European Union or other third countries. The global capitalism has made it possible for a few to benefit from such relations. But how can the Israeli regime ever be a friend of any Muslim country, as the regime preaches intolerance towards Islam?
Given the common feeling in the Muslim-majority Bangladesh, it seems impossible for the government to have any kind of relations with Israel or even welcome the Israeli government with the UAE and Bahrain. But no matter how suicidal for the government and Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, there are a number of Bangladeshi contractors, businessmen, sweatshop owners, or immigration middlemen who seek to manipulate the natural course and discourse of the country to make benefit from the normalization of ties with Israel.
People of Bangladesh very strongly support the cause of the Palestinians, and is very much inherent in their thinking, feeling. So people of the government of Bangladesh will not go against the will of the people of this country, because Bangladesh is a country which always stands for justice, and the cause of the Palestinians is very just claim. So I think Bangladesh will continue to support the cause of the Palestinians and will not normalize the relation with Israel against the will of the people.
Normal people never give up the Palestinian hopes for money or under US or Saudi threats, but there are those who are willing to sacrifice all noble causes for profit. For them, sweatshop productions for the West shouldn't stop. Natural gas and ecological resources should keep flowing to India, and the human labor business in the Persian Gulf Arab countries must flourish. This way, they make sure the Bangladeshi government or people cannot disturb the signatories of the so-called Abraham Accord.
Let's just take a look at how the global media has covered the issue.
Israel's limited diplomacy in South Asia helped it when Nepal and Bhutan abstained during the voting of UN General Assembly Resolution 3379, which described Israel's founding philosophy of Zionism as equivalent to racism. This resolution basically equaled Zionism with apartheid of South Africa, causing international isolation of the Jewish state. India, despite being a secret recipient of Israeli military support during 1962 and subsequently, had supported the resolution on November 10, 1975. Netanyahu gave up on the legal enactment of annexation, but he is still pursuing the process of annexation, perpetuating complete domination over the West Bank and its residents, Michael Sfard, a lawyer who advises human rights groups in Israel, said. The UAE have not received any assurance that Israel will not expand settlements, establish new ones, or consolidate the Israeli bureaucracy in the territory, he added. Although Nepal was the first South Asian country to establish diplomatic relations with Israel and the two enjoy a strong relationship, Kathmandu says it recognizes the rights of the Palestinians. The Nepali government has voted in favor of Palestine recognition and against the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital at the United Nations, but has always tried not to appear against the US or Israel, as the country is constantly under threats of aid cut by the US authorities. After voting in favor of a UN General Assembly resolution criticizing the US move to shift its embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, Nepali officials defended their decision as consistent with the country's historic position on Israel and Palestine and not exactly against Washington. Bhutan is one of those countries who have stopped taking any steps in the direction of accepting the existence of Israel as a nation. Israel doesn't seem to be a particularly high priority for Thimphu, as the kingdom has no diplomatic relations, even with its northern neighbor, China.
The proponents of the Israeli formalization say that the deal immediately stops the annexation of the West Bank. But Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has shattered their illusion. Such an agreement can never put restraint on the expansionist Israeli policies, but would further help the Israeli regime expand beyond the land it has already occupied. There are numerous reports about clandestine relations with Israel, but most countries never dared to tarnish their image with association to the atrocities committed by the Israeli regime. However, the agreement for formal recognition of diplomatic ties by the UAE and Bahrain can serve as a pilot operation devised by the US and Saudi Arabia to check the global response and encourage others to follow suit.
Like many countries that cannot bear the stigma of formal ties with Israel, Maldives has had an on-again, off-again relations with the Zionist regime. The Muslim country established diplomatic relations with Israel in 1965 and suspended them in 1974. In 2009, under President Mohamed Nasheed, the Maldives signed cooperation agreements with Israel on tourism, health, and education and culture. However, the renewed relationship did not develop into full diplomatic relations. In July 2014, under President Abdullah Yameen, the Maldives terminated the cooperation agreements with Israel and announced a boycott of Israeli products as Israel launched a military operation in Gaza. Following the announcement of the agreement with Israel, the Maldivian foreign minister expressed support for the Palestinians and denied having talks with Israel. Dunia Mamun underscored that Male would fully back Palestine at international forums such as the United Nations Human Rights Council. Sri Lankan's ties with Israel follow a similar path. President Jayawardene established ties with Israel. They were suspended under President Premadasa but restored in 2000. In February this year, Israel offered Sri Lanka technology in various sectors, which was welcomed by the newly elected President Rajapaksa. But in June, the Sri Lankan government raised concerns over the human rights situation in Palestine and called on Israel to halt annexation activities in the occupied territories.
Now, to learn more about this issue, we are joined by Mr. Zafar Bangash. He's the director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. Mr. Bangash, welcome to the subcontinent. So, how much do you think the people of the subcontinent support the Palestinian cause?
The people of the subcontinent are overwhelmingly in favor of the Palestinian people's struggle for self-determination. There are, of course, many reasons for that. These relate to
the fact that when we talk about Muslims, for instance, for them, Palestine, the Holy Land, as well as Al-Quds, Masjid Al-Aqsa, hold enormous spiritual significance. Secondly, for them, Palestine is also important because it is closely linked in the minds of the people in the subcontinent with the struggle of the people of Kashmir. And both struggles obviously date back to the same time, back to 1947, and the same colonialist power, Britain, that was behind these intrigues that have caused such enormous suffering both to the Palestinian people as well as the people of Kashmir. So this is, first of all, on the Muslim, from the Muslim perspective. There is also, of course, another factor, and that is that the people of the subcontinent are, generally speaking, quite well informed about international relations, unlike, for instance, people in the Middle East. And of course, they have governments over there that are very oppressive, that do not allow the people to express their views. But the people of the subcontinent are not only quite free to express their views, also they are not afraid to express their views and to express their sentiments. So all of these factors combined go towards heightening the awareness as well as the concern of the people of the subcontinent towards the struggle of the Palestinian people, as well as the liberation of Palestine.
Okay, so you're saying that the issue is similar to the Kashmir issue, and Muslims particularly are in overwhelming support of the Palestinian people. And there are reports that in the 1980s, thousands of Bangladeshi youth volunteered to fight for the Palestinian Liberation Organization. What is behind such massive support for Palestine? Can we say that they understand the settler colonial project, since they themselves lived under a colonial rule?
Well, there is no doubt that the experience of the people of the subcontinent under colonialism has played a significant role in shaping their thinking. But I think we need to keep in mind that the struggle for Palestine, or the support of the people of the subcontinent for the struggle in Palestine, as well as other Islamic causes, for instance, in the 1920s, there was what came to be called the Khilafat movement, when the Turks abolished the Ottoman Khilafa. There was a massive movement in the subcontinent at the time, although it was under British colonialism, but people were extremely angry with that, and they wanted to struggle, go to Turkey and to strive to see if the Khilafah could be saved. So there is a very long history in the subcontinent of people's awareness. And of course, they also realize that colonialism has played a very negative and destructive role in many of these areas, whether it's in Palestine, in Kashmir, in Cyprus, you know, a number of other places in the world. And so there is a deep understanding and appreciation of the struggle of people for justice and for their fundamental rights. And that is what explains their deep attachment, even though I don't think we should look at it from a nationalistic point of view, because the people in the subcontinent, especially the Muslims, of course, they look upon themselves as being part of one ummah. And that is what they express in terms of their empathy and support for the Palestinian cause.
Mr. Pankaj, before we take the next question, let's just take a look at how the global media has covered the issue.
There are hundreds of Bangladeshis who fought for Palestinian self-determination and are buried in Palestinian Liberation Organization PLO graves in Lebanon. During the 1982 Lebanon War, 400 Bangladeshi fighters were captured by the Israeli military. Fatih Abu al-Iradat, a PLO secretary, estimated around 1,000 to 1,500 Bangladeshi fighters were involved in the war. In 1987, the Bangladeshi government estimated that around 8,000 Bangladeshi youths had volunteered to fight for the PLO following Arafat's visit to the country. It should be clear that Bangladesh is not against Jews. It is only against Israel's occupation of Palestine. Bangladesh generously recognized few Jews for their contribution to Bangladesh. Among them, General J.F.R. Jacob, architect Louis I. Kahn, are mentionable. Jewish military officer Jacob played a vital role in providing military assistance to Bengali guerrillas in 1971. He was recognized as a friend of liberation war by Bangladesh. The famous Jewish architect Louis I. Kahn, who designed our visually pleasing parliament building, is remembered warmly here in Dhaka. Export Promotion Bureau EPB data shows that in fiscal year 2012 to 2013, Bangladesh has exported goods worth about $22,435 to Israel, while in 2011 to 2012, the amount was $8,364. The maximum amount of exports took place in 2011 when export earnings fetched $30,545. And in 2009 to 2010, the amount was $17,861. During these years under review, Bangladesh mainly exported apparel, knit and textile products to Israel. Besides garments items, some ceramic items were also exported. Israel imported $17,571 and $26,558 in 2012 and 2013, respectively.
All right, welcome back, Mr. Bangash, and welcome back to the audience as well. So, Mr. Bangash, you said that there's a long history of colonial rule, and that certainly has an impact on the way things run in the subcontinent. Would the normalization of relations between some Arab countries and Israel impact the geopolitics of the subcontinent?
Yes, this is true that most of the countries of the subcontinent have very close ties with the Persian Gulf countries as well as Saudi Arabia. And then you have India, which is the largest of the countries in the region, that has also very deep ties with the Zionist state of Israel. Now, as far as the people are concerned, I don't think that they will support any normalization with the Zionist occupying regime, because for them, Palestine, Al-Quds, and Masjid Al-Aqsa are very dear to them, and they will continue to strive and struggle regardless of how their governments conduct their affairs. Of course, you know, in the subcontinent, these governments are or these countries are to a large extent dependent on their expatriate labor force in the Persian Gulf countries. But I think when it comes to the crunch, I think the governments, and I can say this quite safely with respect to Pakistan, for instance, it will not compromise on this principle. India, of course, already has compromised, but I'm not suggesting that the people or the overwhelming majority of people in India have accepted that policy. But in Pakistan, I can say with great confidence that both the people and the government will not compromise on the issue of Palestine. Now, of course, for the people, they have a sentimental attachment to Palestine, but the government, it also has a political dimension in the sense that if the government of Pakistan were to accept normalization of relations with the Zionist state of Israel, then it would have to accept that India's occupation of Kashmir is legitimate. And that's something that Pakistan simply will not accept. And so we see that even though there may be challenges and difficulties for governments in the subcontinent, as far as the people are concerned, they simply will not compromise.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bangash, for being with us on our show. It was nice having you here. Let's see how people on social media see this situation.
As a Nepalese, Irmak Aidoya declares his support for the Palestinians and considers the Israeli regime as the worst threat to security. This tweet provides a very brief overview of Sri Lanka-Palestine relations. This user shares some pictures of the Palestinians in the West Bank. And finally, let's take a look at the picture shared by Shadi describing the current situation of Gaza and the Palestinians.
And that was our episode covering the reactions of different nations across the subcontinent to the recognition of Israel. We'll meet next week.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3rd, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq. Greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week.
What kind of government is the French government? The same government offered the most help to a bloodthirsty wolf named Saddam. Of course, we cannot say that it offered more support than other governments. It was one of the main supporters of Saddam in that war. It provided that bloodthirsty wolf with advanced planes and advanced equipment, and they were not ashamed of doing it, as they have acknowledged it. This is related to their behavior towards terrorists and the like. But you have also witnessed how they treated their people during the Saturday Yellow Vest demonstrations held last year. That is while they claim to be interested in freedom, human rights, and other such values. I believe that these are the two sides of the same coin. In other words, defending that act of cultural savagery and the criminal action taken by a cartoonist is one side of the coin, and the other is defending and helping the Munafiqeen and Saddam. These are the two sides of the same coin.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, my Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Oh.
Such courses of action have been repeatedly adopted in European countries and in the U.S. The incidents related to insulting the Holy Quran and the Holy Prophet have frequently occurred in Western countries, in both the U.S. and European countries. But such incidents cannot damage the honor, magnificence, and greatness of the Holy Prophet of Islam in the slightest manner. It is completely clear that the enlightened personality of the Messenger of Mercy cannot be damaged with these actions. By Allah's favor, this sun shines more brightly on a daily basis. Just as the thugs in Mecca and Taif could not erase the name of the Holy Prophet of Islam, despite all the efforts that they made, these excellencies will not be able to damage the Holy Prophet either. However, one can understand a point from this incident, that these courses of action show the dark nature of the Western civilization.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
In the limelight.
For the first time, President Donald Trump has admitted that coronavirus is running wild across the United States, in contrast with his statements throughout the election campaign that the country was rounding the turn on the pandemic. As new COVID infections in the United States approached 200,000 a day, Donald Trump took to Twitter on Saturday night, 21st of November, to insist things were bad outside the United States as well. The fake news is not talking about the fact that COVID is running wild all over the world, not just in the US. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, Donald Trump Appears to Admit COVID is Running Wild in the US. Stay with us for more. For the first time, President Donald Trump has admitted that coronavirus is running wild across the United States, in contrast with his statements throughout the election campaign that the country was rounding the turn on the pandemic. As new COVID infections in the U.S. approached 200,000 a day, Donald Trump took to Twitter on Saturday night, 21st of November, to insist things were bad outside the United States as well. The fake news is not talking about the fact that COVID is running wild all over the world, not just in the US. I was at the virtual G20 meeting early this morning, and the biggest subject was COVID. We will be healing fast, especially with our vaccines. That was Donald Trump's tweet on Saturday night, 21st of November. On Friday, the U.S. recorded 195,500 new cases of coronavirus, a global and U.S. record, according to Johns Hopkins University data. On Saturday, the country passed 12 million cases, by far the largest total in the world. During the election campaign, Trump repeatedly asserted that the United States was rounding the turn on coronavirus and that the country would hear less about the pandemic after 4th of November. In his tweets late on Saturday night, 21st of November, he insisted that fake news forgets to mention that far fewer people are dying when they get COVID. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration, meanwhile, said on Saturday that it had issued an emergency use authorization for the Regeneron Pharmaceuticals antibody therapy that was given to President Trump when he had COVID-19 in October. It comes as daily deaths in the United States were approaching the figures seen during the first months of the pandemic. On Thursday, more than 2,000 Americans died from COVID-19, the highest figure since May. President Trump said at the virtual G20 summit early on Saturday that the biggest subject was COVID. We will be healing fast, especially with our vaccines. Trump also implied to the G20 leaders that he would be working with them in the future. I look forward to working with you again for a long time, Donald Trump told world leaders at the virtual G20 summit. Ahead of the summit, the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called on G20 to join COVAX, an international initiative to distribute COVID-19 vaccines to countries worldwide. The United States has so far declined to join under the Trump administration. Instead, the US and other countries like Britain, France, and Germany, which are all G20 nations, have directly negotiated deals with pharmaceutical companies to receive billions of doses of the vaccine, meaning that the vast majority of the world's vaccine supply next year is already reserved. The pharmaceutical giant Moderna told the German weekly Welmtel Sonntag that it will charge governments between $25 and $37 per dose of its COVID vaccine candidate, depending on the amount ordered. Our vaccine therefore costs about the same as a flu shot, which is between $10 and $50. The chief executive of Moderna, Stefan Bansal, was quoted as saying. Back in the US, millions were expected to travel for the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday on Thursday, ignoring warnings about spread of the coronavirus. More than a million people flew through airports on Friday, according to data from the Transportation Security Administration, TSA. It was the second heaviest domestic air traffic day in the United States since the start of the pandemic. The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, issued a warning on Saturday, 21st of November, for all people to avoid cruise ship travel because the risk of COVID-19 on board is very high. Last month, the agency issued a framework for a phased resumption of cruise ship operations after a no-sail order issued in March in response to the coronavirus pandemic was to expire. Of the 50 states in the United States, all but one, isolated Hawaii, is currently seeing alarming surges in new cases of the coronavirus. The virus is on the rise so uniformly across the landmass of the United States that records are being shattered almost daily. Almost 12 million cases have been recorded. In just one day, the U.S. notched up 184,000 new cases. Almost 80,000 Americans are currently in hospital fighting for their lives, and the death rate is soaring inexorably towards 2,000 a day, close to the peak it reached back in April. This week, the country passed the grimmest landmark so far, 250,000 dead Americans. and already the total has gone up significantly beyond this tragic milestone. As Michael Osterholm, a member of the coronavirus advisory team assembled by President-elect Joe Biden, put it, "We are in the most dangerous public health period since 1918. Governors and mayors from coast to coast have been scrambling to batten down the hatches, from New York City, where the country's largest public school system was closed on Thursday, barely 2 months after it reopened, to California, where Governor Gavin Newsom announced he was pulling the emergency brake. In America's heartland, President Donald Trump's historic mishandling of the pandemic is coming home to roost. Across the Midwest, many Republican governors have taken their cue straight from President Trump, consistently downplaying the seriousness of the coronavirus pandemic. Governors such as Chrissy Noem of South Dakota, Pete Ricketts of Nebraska, Kim Reynolds of Iowa, and Mike Parson of Missouri. They have downplayed the seriousness of the pandemic. They lied about the pandemic being under control, and at best, they have been ambivalent about wearing face masks. The results are now plain to see. Runaway coronavirus infection levels in the Midwestern United States, and hospitals at breaking point.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Round the World with Reporters.
Thousands in Paris, tens of thousands all over France are protesting for the second time in a week against the global security law. This new law has been voted in the French Parliament and makes it illegal to film and publish images of police officers. For these demonstrators, this new law is a violation of the right to inform.
We will no longer be able to film policemen in action and to put them on the social networks, which is of course very dangerous because nowadays there is a real issue in France about violence from the policemen.
Even at the very beginning of the sanitary crisis, with the total confinement, the police were controlling everybody, asking for their certificate to be able to leave their residence, you know, even though it could eventually be defendable from a sanitary point of view. Now, it has nothing to do with that. This proposed law is not directly connected to the sanitary crisis at all, and they are just giving more powers to the police.
Earlier this week, the police used tear gas and water cannon when protesters took the street in front of the French Parliament. With the new law, it will become illegal to film this kind of police intervention. During the Yellow Vest movement, videos have been used in judicial investigation concerning police violence. With this law, the French state can more easily hide illegal actions committed by police officers. It can also more easily hide scandals, which opens the door for abuse of power.
For us, this law doesn't only concern journalists. During the Yellow Vest movement, we have seen an explosion of police violence. One of the important arms to fight against this is the ability to film the police violence and to denounce it. So this law is also against us, not only against journalists. There is also a surveillance of demonstrators by drones.
The French government says they want a better protection for their police force. But the new French law is seriously criticized by the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, as well as by a large spectrum of the French civil society, journalist associations, trade unions, political parties, and human rights defenders. 1 year of prison and 45,000 euros of penalties, that's what someone risks for publishing the face of a police officer. Many people here say that the French government is using the coronavirus crisis to limit personal and public liberties. Chris Den Hond, Paris.
The U.S. presidential election remains unresolved, but what seems crystal clear is that the nation is more divided at any time than since the 1960s, or perhaps even the 1860s. A new poll found that nearly 80% of America says they are deeply divided on its most foundational values. Whoever is inaugurated in January will face a deeply mistrustful and disbelieving public. As the poll also finds that just 30% of Americans believe the country will grow more united in 2021. For a nation which is the richest in the world and which faces no serious external threat, such levels of disharmony are shocking even to many Americans themselves.
The far right, that's really come from almost like Trumpism, if that movement still stays strong, we can see more conflict in the next 4 years. And I think it's really just dependent on how Joe Biden kind of handles the next 4 years, and also what kind of information is really getting flown out of the far right and whether that gets filtered or not or whether that gets spread very rapidly.
Distrust is not something which grows overnight. Many attribute the division to the American liberals' obsession with so-called identity politics, which divides and redivides people into smaller and smaller tribes based on gender, race, ethnicity, urban, rural, coastal, inland, and on and on. U.S. conservatives are criticized for having a limited view of unity due to an us versus them mentality, which leaves little room for change or modernization.
Right. I think that Republicans and Democrats have become almost like their own tribes where they're not willing to give an inch to the other. I hope that's not going to continue. And I hope that the rhetoric becomes less incendiary as we move forward. But I don't think that Trump is doing anything but fomenting more discontent among groups of people that are already tribalized and having a hard time getting together.
The United States is proving unable to resolve a host of enormous problems. Protecting from the coronavirus pandemic, Great Depression-era levels of unemployment alongside a skyrocketing Wall Street, endemic economic inequality which has exploded in 2020, constant racial discrimination, record disharmony between genders, a Congress which is half as popular as an often deeply unpopular president, and of course, a disputed election, the third in six tries. The poll makes it clear that belief in the nation's division is not a partisan issue, as Democrats, Republicans, and Independents all agree in similar proportions. Americans can only seem to agree on one thing, that they really, deeply disagree. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Capital Sana'a hosted the first scientific conference on cancerous diseases with a focus on gynecological cancers, attended by a large number of specialized doctors and academics under the sponsorship of the Yemeni Health Ministry.
We thought about enhancing the role of person, individual roles, families, communities, to be like sharing us our concern about their health, by educating them, by raise awareness about the signs and symptoms of cancers.
Since 2015, the number of cancer cases in Yemen has increased rapidly. According to the Undersecretary of the Health Ministry, Ali Jahaf, he says this is due to the prohibited arms used by the U.S.-Saudi coalition over the past years.
That they have used forbidden
armament in bombing Yemen.
Yemeni army says it has discovered large quantities of U.S.-built munitions at the positions of Saudi mercenaries while conducting clean-up operations in the provinces of Marib and Al-Bayda. Saudi Arabia and a number of its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 in order to bring for Riyadh-friendly President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi back to power. Riyadh is the largest buyer of American-made weaponry. Trump signed an arms deal worth $110 billion with Saudi Arabia in May 2017. The Saudi military aggression against Yemen, coupled with a naval blockade, has killed hundreds of thousands of people and plunged Yemen into what UN says the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Military camps have been set up to help overwhelmed reception facilities, but local authorities say the government is not doing enough. The island's president, Antonio Morales, has denounced what he calls the Ministry of Interior's continued contempt for migrants and the island, demanding the resignation of those responsible. Driven by economic hardship, around 17,000 migrants have arrived on the Canary Islands this year. According to Spain's Interior Ministry, that's a 1,000% increase from 2019. In 2019, 1,885 migrants drowned in the Mediterranean Sea, and 2020's death toll is fast approaching 1,000. Open Arms, the only NGO permitted to carry out search and rescue missions at present, wrote on Twitter, "Despite the enormous commitment of our medical team, a six-month-old baby has just died. We requested an urgent evacuation for him and other people in serious conditions, but he didn't make it. How much pain and sorrow." The International Criminal Court has sued the European Union, saying member states should be prosecuted for the deaths of thousands of migrants who have drowned in the Mediterranean. In its 245-page document, the ICC says the EU's deterrence-based migration policy, which came into force after 2014, sacrifices the lives of migrants in distress at sea to dissuade others from seeking a safe haven in Europe. Bianca Rahimi, London.
As the G20 summit is about to kick off in Saudi Arabia, Amnesty International is calling on the attendees of the meeting to take the kingdom to task for its appalling human rights record. The Crown had planned to promote its contentious reform agenda to the world and show Saudi Arabia is open for business. However, Riyadh summit will be solely held in the form of a virtual meeting due to the coronavirus restrictions. Amnesty International is urging G20 leaders to join the call for the immediate release of a number of jailed women's rights activists arrested in 2018.
What we said on the eve of the G20 is that Saudi Arabia's real change makers, the activists who spearheaded campaigns for women's rights, are in jail or facing trial. Riyadh is an inappropriate host.
Since assuming the G20 presidency in December last year, Riyadh has publicized new initiatives on women's employment opportunities, claiming that the kingdom is strongly committed to empowering women and girls.
On the occasion of the G20 summit, the Embassy of Saudi Arabia in Italy has organized a webinar on females' inclusion in society. Human rights groups have slammed these initiatives as mere attempts to reshape the kingdom's image through expensive PR campaigns, presenting Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as a reformer.
The Crown has spent billions of dollars hosting major political, entertainment, cultural and sporting events as a deliberate strategy to deflect from the country's image as a pervasive human rights violator, to whitewash its dismal rights record.
Saudi Arabia is using the G20 meeting in Riyadh to build legitimacy. Bear in mind that bin Salman is behind the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The kingdom is cashing in on Donald Trump's staunch support all along the way.
Saudi Arabia is the first Arab nation to host the G20 summit. The meeting of the leaders of the world's most industrialized countries and emerging economies will be held on November 21st and 22nd. Max Civili, Rome.